This episode of Promised Land uses audio clips that contain language and subject matter that are graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I've never lied to you. Your Bible is full of lies. Your sky God makes no sense. If he was all perfect, why don't he come down and do something? If he can heal everybody in a minute, why doesn't he heal them all? Why did he make all these different races to fight and to kill? Why did he bring some into the world born blind? America, 1973. Christian America. Jehovah's America. Bible America, 1973. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain by following me. Why don't you deny yourself? Why don't you deny yourself? Why don't you say yes to this cause and no to that slave system? I thank you. I thank you. I thank you because my words are spirit and my words are life. This is a revolution that will heal you. This is a father that will save you. This is one that will shepherd you through every storm.
Jonestown, in the beginning of 1977, was a peaceful but busy place to be. Pioneers worked tirelessly from day to night, but they found camaraderie in each other. Even though the work was hard, they made time to spend the evenings together, eating, laughing, and singing. They had no one to directly watch over them and no one to punish them if they stepped out of line. They grew used to the unforgiving nature of living in the jungle and found the beauty that it also brought. Not many newcomers arrived, aside from a few teens who couldn't stay out of trouble back in the States. That was until May of 1977, when people started to come more than a dozen at a time. Members were greeted with a song as they arrived in Jonestown. Even though many newcomers were disappointed with Jonestown, as it was nothing like the tropical paradise Jones had bragged it to be, the atmosphere was still light and happy. To see each other and members were warmly welcomed. That was until Jim Jones moved to Jonestown. Housing instantly became a problem in Jonestown. Each cottage built was built to hold around 6 people each. Pioneers didn't prioritize building the cottages because, as per the contract with the Guyanese government, the plan was to build for 5 years before the mission would be ready to take on its residents. Because attention had to be solely focused on building more cottages, more essential work was neglected, such as clearing out more of the jungle. Jones, now residing in Jonestown, wanted as many of his followers there as he could get. He had to have control over everything, including his people, and needed them there with him to assert his control. The lack of housing and limited food supply was the least of his worries. He needed to have his utopia and prove it to the world that his socialist example was in fact working. Nothing was to be done in Jonestown without Jim Jones's approval first, including relationships. Anyone wanting to start a new relationship had to apply for permission from Jones and also apply for permission to end the relationship. All mail incoming and outgoing was read by Jones or one of his lieutenants. All outgoing mail was to only speak highly on Jonestown and send some message of this tropical paradise that they were living in. If anything was worded incorrectly, it would be crossed out and instructions were given in the margins on how to better word the letter. It was then sent back to the writer to correct before being allowed to be sent to the United States. Privacy was non-existent in Jonestown. Cottages were packed with more than a dozen people per cottage, with hard, uncomfortable bunk beds, and outhouses built around the settlement were always overcrowded. Toilet paper was not provided once Jonestown numbers grew, so leaves were used instead. Water was very limited in the showers, so everyone was limited to 2 minutes to shower and advised not to drink the water as it was polluted.
Capacity to acquire.
Well, we're at the airport and you have to get going, I know, really quick, but what do you think is the most significant accomplishment of the Jonestown community?
The very fact that the Jonestown community gives people hope, and it demonstrates in a very few years that people can dream great dreams, and putting blood, sweat, tears, and a little personal sacrifice, not in terms of the personal sacrifice in terms of suffering, but in terms of conveniences of industrial age, that they can see before their very eyes, dreams come true. And this is the hope. This is the message. And I'm hopeful that this message will be propagated and spreaded. And I, for one, can do everything possible to spread the message. And I have come to Jonestown. I've seen the wave of the future in terms of living in the present, and that's what I find very intriguing and challenging.
Thank you very much.
Jones, of course, lived a life of luxury compared to his people. He lived in a private cabin with Carolyn, Maria, John Victor, and Chemo, with soft beds, a private bathroom, a generator-powered refrigerator that held soft drinks and snacks, and a personal fan. Jones also had all the drugs he could ever need, as Jonestown was constantly being stocked with medicine by mission doctor Larry Schacht. Jones's cabin was connected to the camp radio room, so he was able to make calls through the United States and make announcements throughout Jonestown without ever having to leave the comfort of his home. Funding for Jonestown was not pouring in like money used to back in the States. The Redwood Valley Church and the Los Angeles Church were up for sale, and Marcelin was struggling to keep the San Francisco church going. Collections in San Francisco that were once totaling $5,000 were now a few hundred per service. With costs to keep up Jonestown and food supply, the temple was not making enough money to cover the monthly costs, which averaged around $600,000 a month. Jones hoped to sell surplus of crops, but there were none available. Temple members took to the streets in Georgetown asking for donations, but were quickly out of options for donations as there were no other cities close by. Jonestown residents started to make toys such as cars and trains out of wood, little dolls from scraps of materials, and soaps. These were sold in open-air markets in Georgetown and were able to bring in several thousand dollars a month, but this was still not good enough. When new members would arrive in Jonestown, residents would go through their luggage taking their passports to be held by Jones. All jewelry or anything of value was taken to be sold at the market in Georgetown, and all clothes were taken to be added to the inventory in the communal mission warehouse. Residents were left with nothing but the clothes on their backs. Food supply in Jonestown was the biggest concern of all. With residents doing hard labor in the jungle all day, they needed to have lots of calories and protein. Jones calculated that to serve 900 people meat for a meal would average $2,000 for a single meal. Rice became a large staple in Jonestown compared to the peanut butter sandwiches in the States. The rice would be covered in watered-down gravy with tiny specks of meat used sparingly. Beverages were limited to water or Flavor Aid, as Kool-Aid was too expensive to be able to serve. Desserts were rare in Jonestown, aside from a single cookie Jones would personally hand out to each member. Punishments were still a thing in Jonestown. Jonestown established the Learning Crew as a means for punishing members. Rule breakers were sent to the Learning Crew, where they were to do everything separated from others. No one was allowed to speak or look at anyone on the learning crew. People on the learning crew were to run no matter where they were going, and learning crew supervisors were watching and reporting everything back to Jones. There was no set limit on how long you would be on the learning crew. It was up to Jones to allow you to return back to the main group.
Willie Malone, fifth time, 6 day, too long. Wayne McCall, fourth time. Okay, works good, attitude good. Last 3 days. Okay, Wayne. Where are you, Wayne? Wayne! Wayne, you're going to have to shout and get the Lord's spirit in you tonight. Wayne! Wayne, 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 Wayne. You got to get blessed. You got to bless. You got to get speak in tongues. You got to shout. You got to shout up and down the aisle. You want to get off a learning crew? You do? Well, you seen him get shouting. Did you see him shouting a while ago?
Get in the spirit, Wayne.
Get in the spirit. Shout, you know. Woo!
Get the spirit, Wayne. Show us how to
do it. Wayne, it's worth getting off the learning crew. That's it, sister. That's sister. Show him. Chill out. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. Glory! Make fun of this shit. I want to get this shit out of here because religion is back here. It was at the dinner table tonight. Somehow, all of you get up. Come on, make fun of it. Jesus, Jesus. Oh! John here. Look at Professor Roller. Professor Roller back there has got the spirit. Hey!
Everyone in Jonestown were required to attend nightly meetings in the main pavilion. The pavilion was a large, open-air structure where members would sit shoulder to shoulder on picnic-style benches, and some stood as the numbers of members rose in front of Jones, who sat in a cushioned, oversized lawn chair with a sign over his head, misquoting philosopher George Santayana, stating, quote, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Some of these nightly meetings were entertaining, as Jones, who was once against films, would play some of his personal favorites for everyone, and sometimes would play cartoons or Sesame Street for the children. Most of the time, though, Jones spoke. He would give everyone updates on recent U.S. and world news with his own added adjustments, such as Ku Klux Klan membership rising 100%. There was always something shocking happening in the world that would affect them had he not saved them all and brought them to the promised land. Jones would talk for hours most nights. Though it was lights out at 11 p.m. in Jonestown, Jones would often talk until 2 or 3 in the morning, even though residents were to be up at 6 a.m. Even after the long nightly meetings, residents could not escape Jones. Jonestown had a loudspeaker system that was audible everywhere in the settlement. Jones would sometimes play music through the speaker system, but would oftentimes play previous tapes of his speeches or readdress previous topics from the nights before.
Today, the Soviet Union have warned the United States to abandon development of the neutron bomb and has threatened to give an appropriate answer to such a challenge by a new superweapon that will have dimensions of control of space, said the Soviet Union, if the weapon actually is deployed. This is the first official significance, according to the Chicago Tribune, that indeed the Soviets do have in their possession the laser beam that can knock out all incoming missiles into Soviet countries that ally themselves with them or their own mainland. It was the third such warning in 4 months by Moscow to the United States and its NATO allies. Like the previous warnings, the official statement is getting sterner by the TASS news agency, but it stops short of actually saying that the Soviet Union would develop its own superweapon in abundance. It did suggest, however, this time that they would make neutron weapons themselves. The neutron bombs, as much as they abhorred them, would have to be made by implication because of the U.S. militaristic designs. If the NATO North American Treaty Organization, a fascist group of nations that support USA, England, France, West Germany, fascist Germany, Norway, and USA, if those member countries make their choice in favor of starting the production of the neutron weapon in Europe, all the nations of NATO are in Europe or Scandinavia, such a decision would face the Soviet Union with the absolute necessity to give an appropriate answer by indeed taking up the challenge to build a neutron bomb and to press ahead. We are fearful, said TASS, in the area of weapons that are so destructive that the human mind cannot even conceive of their destructiveness.
When Jones arrived in Guyana, he fully expected that he would have easy access to Prime Minister Burnham anytime he wanted. He was alarmed to find out that he and anyone from Jonestown were forwarded to the Deputy Prime Minister, Ptolemy Reed. Jones wouldn't understand why he was denied access to Burnham, and started to believe Burnham had ties to the CIA and FBI, and that the Guyanese government were in on this plot against him. With lack of progress in Jonestown, and his lack of access to the Prime Minister, Jones grew increasingly upset, and it would show in his nightly lectures in the pavilion. Some members grew tired of Jones and the life in Jonestown, but leaving was next to impossible. With passports being locked away and all personal possessions taken, would make it hard to leave. But then members had the jungle and all the dangers that it held to make it out and be able to leave. Jones also made it clear to anyone who may want to leave that all deserters would have to pay their own way back to the United States, which again was impossible since they had nothing and no contact with anyone outside of Jonestown. Even with all the roadblocks, some still tried. Yolanda Crawford was the first to persuade Jones to allow herself, her mother, and her husband leave back to the United States. She mentioned in her later deposition that she was required to never speak against the church, and she had to sign a number of self-incriminating papers stating things such as she murdered someone and dumped their body in the ocean, and had to leave these papers behind with Jones to use if she ever caused him or the temple any trouble. A few months later, Leon Brossard snuck away in the jungle and managed to make it to Port Kaituma, where he ran into U.S. Counsel Richard McCoy, who was preparing to travel to Jonestown for his first visit. Leon proceeded to tell McCoy how Jonestown was a quote slave colony, and Jones would punish anyone he wanted to by beating them badly and burying them alive. He told McCoy that all he wanted was to return to America and that he had no money or passport. McCoy promised Leon that he would help him. Though Jones denied everything said and called Leon a liar, he agreed to give Leon his passport and pay for his flight back to the States. McCoy also was able to work out with Jones a deal that if anyone wanted to leave, they would be allowed their passport and the temple would pay their way back. McCoy proceeded to talk to residents of Jonestown, asking them if they were happy and if anyone else wanted to leave. No one else spoke out. They expressed that they were happy there, and did so without McCoy feeling they were coached into it, and he believed, and most of them believed it too, for a variety of different reasons. A third of Jonestown's residents were elderly, and they remembered far too well the times when their lives were harder, and with Jones's warnings of the Klan expanding and potential concentration camps, Jonestown was where they wanted to be, with regular meals and a bed to sleep in. There was also close to 300 children in Jonestown, who all had great lives there. They had teachers that truly cared about their education, and none of them were ever disciplined. The other third of the residents were adults who were expected to work all day without complaint. They believed in Jones, even if they didn't believe everything he claimed. Even those who didn't believed in what they were doing and the social message they were sending for future generations. Most were too exhausted to question what Jones preached as far as the CIA and the FBI plotting against them. Between the hard physical labor the small meals, and terrible outhouse conditions, they couldn't think about much at all besides the very basic of thoughts. Even then, if there were some among them who pondered the idea of leaving, Jones knew how to make sure it wouldn't happen again. Jones encouraged members to spy on each other and report to him any signs of disloyalty. It didn't matter if it was family or close friends, no one had secrets, and anyone reported would be subjected to punishments.
"You are insane. You don't understand the dire danger of the jungle. You'd be better lost in a proverbial hell than in a jungle. It's a source of wildlife, a source of food that all of our people could always eat, if you are led by a guide that knows what they're doing. But again, I remind you and I urge upon you, even if you were to get out, the Guyana Defense Force, the police will return you to face our structure and discipline. And again, if you got to Georgetown, you have all kinds of barriers from Guyana authorities releasing you, and you cannot just be released by a passport. You must pass Guyanese release of tax clearance and other clearances. You must have release of the embassy, and now that the embassy is red-faced over someone stealing money off of us, they will report to us also. There is no way you can try to commit treason against this group, to try to betray by leaving this group, until our people are here to safety. The least you can do is to show respect for that. We want our people to safety, and God damn the likes of you that take any risk, cause us any risk, the contrary. Now, back to work and back to production. Step it up, please. Step it up, please. All units are back in the usual points of surveillance. And again, anyone knowing anything critical, that any negative action or talk from anyone going on the ban or any person going for other reasons to Georgetown, report to this office so that they will not go at the midnight time this time until they've improved their behavior or have been confronted about their behavior before they get on board at midnight. Report any negative criticism you hear of any kind, because you are cutting off your own nose to spite your face. It's your throat they're cutting when they're cutting down this place. So keep in mind, it is proper to report in a socialist community. Cuba, Free Cuba has committees of defense and revolution."
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
If someone did want to escape Jonestown, they had to go through the jungle. Jonestown was surrounded on all sides by dense jungle terrain. There was a small road cut for 2 miles that led to a slightly larger road that went another mile or so to Port Kaituma. A pothole-filled airport with little to no air traffic in and out. By the time an escapee would make it to the airport, they would have to wait for a plane to arrive. There would be plenty of time for Jones to send people after the escapee. The other option was try to make it to Matthews Ridge, but that would require traveling directly through the jungle for many miles to a train track that would be over 20 more miles walk. This would be hard on any adult, let alone the worn out, overworked adults in Jonestown. And that's if they would even make it past all the animals and insects in the jungle, or possibly getting lost. So they stayed. With the constant warning from Jones of the CIA, FBI, media, and local government being out to get him and the temple, a new and real threat was beginning to emerge. Former members were starting to meet together, with Elmer and Deanna Myrtle being the host of the gatherings. They knew there was only so much a newspaper could write before the general audience grew tired of the story. They had to come up with something to go on to be able to bring down Jones and the People's Temple, and they found just the way to do it with Grace Stone. Grace was determined to get custody of her son, John Victor, and was willing to do anything to do so. Grace wasn't the only one with a child in Jonestown. Many others had children there or other relatives. Their concern only grew for their family members when letters from Jonestown would arrive and seem almost automated. All letters spoke of the same things: how wonderful Jonestown is, praising Jim Jones in every way, and even a handful of younger women who wrote home telling their parents of their engagement to the mission doctor, Larry Schacht. The group had one main intention, and that was to rescue their family and friends from Jonestown. They named their group the Concerned Relatives.
Yeah. Roger, Roger. My name is Harriet Trock. I have a law degree and I'm currently teaching at the Jonestown Community School. I have a statement to make on behalf of People's Temple in response to the grossly false and malicious statements that continue to be made about our community here in Guyana. Do you copy? Individuals participating in a self-styled group of concerned relatives have now publicly threatened to hire mercenaries to illegally enter Guyana and use whatever means necessary, including armed attack and kidnap, to capture members of the People's Temple community. These threats were made public in a California newspaper. People's Temple has already alerted the President, the U.S. State Department, and appropriate government officials in Guyana. Do you copy?
On August 18, 1977, Gray Stone appeared in a San Francisco court to formally request custody of her son. The judge ruled that Jones was to appear in court on September 9th to show cause as to why Gray should not have custody of John Victor. Jones was, of course, already prepared for this and had statements from Temple members stating that Grace was a threat to her son, and also stated that Tim Stone had asked Jones to sleep with his wife and she became pregnant and refused to get an abortion. He continued to state that he had custody of their son because he feels Grace is a real threat to the child's safety and well-being. Jones's legal problems only grew from there. Grace filed for a divorce from Tim Stone around the same time as she filed for custody for John Victor. And the judge presiding over the divorce awarded Grace full custody of her son and ordered Jones to produce John Victor in court on October 6th, stating, quote, "Claimant Reverend Jim Jones is advised that failure to appear at the time and place designated may result in a decision adverse to himself, and a previous declaration of statement signed by either petitioner Grace Stone or respondent Tim Stone authorizing claimant Jones to act as guardian of said minor child is hereby declared null and void." This changed everything. The Temple had filed permission forms from parents giving custody rights to People's Temple. If Grace was able to take John Victor back from Jones's custody, then what is stopping other parents from legally getting rights back to their children? What would Jonestown be if all the children were taken, and what would stop adults from leaving as well once their children were gone? This could end Jonestown, People's Temple, and Jim Jones. As a result, Jones's paranoia ramped up to total panic. At the same time as the judge's ruling, Grace's attorney, Jeffrey Haas, wrote to Temple attorney Charles Gary and stated the following, quote, "In accordance with Judge King's directive, please find enclosed a copy of the order arising out of the hearing on August 19, 1977. Demand is hereby made on you in your capacity as the legal representative of both People's Temple and Mr. Jim Jones for the return of the minor child, John Victor, to his mother in accordance with the court order. I trust that we can expect your cooperation and compliance."
The arrest order's been on me and on George Touche over these kids since hell, September. Now, if they wanted to arrest me very badly, Inspector Benjamin's been in here, and Inspector Brown, the commander of the police, if they wanted to arrest me, they'd have tried to arrest me when they come to visit me. They'd have tried to arrest me when I was in Port Katuma and speaking to 2,000 people. They said there were 2,000 people that was packed in the auditorium and outside, the principal said, and it looked like a hell of a lot of a crowd to me. They're on the rafters. They could have arrested me then if they had wanted to arrest me. But they're saying if I go into, see, I'm in violation of the law. I refuse to turn over people. United States at first, when the government was weak and all the leaders were outside of the country. They let the United States conspiracy get here and make a court case in the court here. Do you understand that? And so they started a legal action demanding that I turn over the child and Joyce turn over the child, and we refused. So we're in violation of the law. I said, we will die before we turn over any child. It was Dana, and the one attorney represented Dana, Truss, and John, my son. I guess all of you know the background of John being my son, don't you? Anybody didn't know he was my son? You've been listening at home, you'd know that. All the new people know that. Because Tim Stone's running around in women's clothing, and he may have been a provocateur from the beginning. Shit. Dr. Reese said this morning, he said it looked like a setup to him to try to get me in a bag. So he may have been an agent a long, long way back, a long, long time ago. But anyway, he was running around women's clothing, and Grace was about to leave him, and he was having a shit fit. Wake up, goddammit! Everybody gets centered in one place, in one position. I said, please realize, as I said, that we are in wartime situation. It's too bad some of you didn't get out there in the war and realize what it is to fight for what you believe. Who's going and without any clearance? I didn't get nobody no clearance. Hold it. Stand up, please. Stand up. Now, you people going to take notice that we're in a war emergency room. Next time, I'm going to fire it over your heads. Sit down. If you want to get out of here, you clear it. I don't want to put the gun on our own people. How do we know we're not one of you a CIA agent when you're moving? It's funny, since the last group came in, all this shit began, we'd had weeks apiece. Funny kind of correlation.
The letter caused Jones no more concern. He stood by his decision of he and the boy staying in Jonestown, and all U.S. court orders were to be ignored. But Grace was far from giving up her son. She and her attorney, Haas, took the fight to Jones. In September of 1977, Haas flew to Georgetown and appeared in a Guyanese courtroom requesting the U.S. order to be honored in Guyana. Justice Aubrey Bishop issued an order for Jones and John Victor to appear in his courtroom on September 8th, where Jones would have to show cause of why John Victor should not be awarded to his mother. Haas then flew with the order to Port Kaituma and made his way to Jonestown with a Guyanese officer to deliver the order to Jones. Jones, having temple informants everywhere in Guyana, knew Haas was in Georgetown the moment he stepped foot off a plane. He needed to come up with a plan to prove enemies were always out there and out to get him in People's Temple. So he staged an attack on himself the night before Haas made his appearance in Justice Bishop's courtroom. Jones, with the help of his son Jim Jr., made the plans. Jim Jr. was to wait in the brush across from Jones's private quarters. When Jones walked out, Jim Jr. was to fire shots nowhere near Jones, but to make it seem like someone was hiding in the jungle, ready to kill Jones at any time. This was to make sure everyone was always alert from now on. When Haas and the Guyanese officer arrived at Jonestown gates, Maria Katsaris was there waiting. She asked why they were there and what they wanted, where Haas explained he had some Guyanese Supreme Court business and needed to speak to Jones. Maria Katsaris told the men that Jones was away, and they left to await further instructions from Justice Bishop on how to deliver the order to make sure it was obeyed. Jones's paranoia grew to an all-time high at this point. He started to question motives of everyone. Why did Justice Bishop rule in favor of the Stones? Why was Haas flown on a Guyanese military plane to Port Kaituma? Was the Prime Minister and his government about to betray Jones in the People's Temple? He needed answers, and fast. He radioed his people in Georgetown and ordered them to contact Deputy Prime Minister Reed and demand to know what is going on, and received word back that Reed was actually in America at that time on official business. To Jones and his increased paranoia, this wasn't a coincidence. disprove to Jones that the Guyanese government, as well as the US government, were out to destroy People's Temple and himself. This conclusion initiated Jones's most extreme reaction yet. On the afternoon of September 7th, one day before Jones was set to appear before Justice Bishop with John Victor, an announcement came over the loudspeaker system, screaming that everyone was to get back as soon as they can. Everyone rushed into the pavilion to see what was going on. Jones got on the loudspeaker and announced that they were under attack and that everyone should prepare for an immediate fight.
But I don't ever say hate is your enemy. Love has practically caused me to just get you destroyed. If I had hated a little more, just a little more, we would have had a little less trouble. But I look at my faults analytically. Sure, you got love, principle, but don't say hate is my enemy. What did they say? What's that words? Hate is my enemy. I gotta fight it day and night. And what else is the line? Love is the only weapon. Shit! Bullshit! Martin Luther King died with love. Kennedy died talking about something he couldn't even understand, some kind of generalized love, and he never even backed it up. He shut down. Bullshit! Love is the only weapon with which I got to fight. I got a hell of a lot of weapons to fight. I got my claws, I got compasses, I got guns, I got dynamite, I got a hell of a lot to fight. I'll fight! I'll fight! I will fight! I will fight! I will fight! I will fight! And hear it in the night.
All security was to arm themselves with rifles, handguns, and crossbows, and stand in the mission kitchen to have a direct shot of the entrance gate. Jones ordered Jim Jr. and another team to gather the temple's gold bars into bags and take them out into the jungle for safekeeping. They were to stay with the gold, and if anything happened to Jones, they were instructed to take the gold to the Soviet embassy in Georgetown to show a defiant demonstration of the temple's socialist beliefs. Jones told everyone else that they were coming to take away not only John Victor, but all the children in Jonestown, and they had to fight to protect their children, that Tim Stone was behind everything. Hours had passed and everyone grew exhausted after working in the fields all day and now standing guard. Jones did not let up. Food and water was passed around as they stood guard. Jones radioed to San Francisco and told Marcelin to find out why Reed was in the United States and to get a hold of him and have him promise that Jones did not have to comply with the orders of Justice Bishop. Days had started to pass with everyone remaining in place ready for an attack. Reed still could not be located, and the date Justice Bishop ordered Jones to court had come and gone. Jones changed tactics and announced that everyone would be sent to Port Kaituma in shifts, where their boat, the Cujo, would transport them down to Cuba, where they would ask for refuge. The first batch of people, all seniors, were loaded onto a truck and were rushed into the dark to get aboard the Cujo, where one elderly woman fell, not being able to see well, and broke her hip. Word got back to Jones of this incident, and he immediately called off the truck to bring everyone back, and no further word of Cuba was mentioned again.
Check or no check? You sons of bitches, we'll give them a white knight. What in the hell is going on? Remind me of some scene I saw so long time ago, some fucking funeral, I don't know. They got Moten in the crowd. Shit, you people are the ones going, you getting a blessing. You're getting a blessing. You avoid a stroke walking around. Okay, go. Go. Go!
Hey, Dan, I think I'm a very dependent personally on your leadership, on the family being intact. I think a lot of other people are. I think if we go to Cuba, we won't be in the same position. Maybe in the beginning they'll accept us as an intact group with your leadership. We might not always be in that position. You're very humble about saying that you'll do whatever is necessary and, you know, do whatever work is necessary.
By the way, they should be writing up a trap, or somebody should write up, and there should be some notes. What's the matter? Write some notes on the demand, why we think it should be a group intact. Maybe you make some cases intellectually that might appeal to the Cubans. And assurances that if there's any difficulty, we will certainly, change. I mean, if anybody can take out and can educate, we will more than gladly. Those that can fit in and they can make analysis of it, and we're always happy. And then if we're all once there, you know, we got the same situation we got here. We can white knight one basis or another. Right on.
On September 9th, Haas returned to Jonestown, where Stephen Jones was standing guard. Justice Bishop had ruled that if copies of his order were posted around the Jonestown settlement, Jones would be considered to have received the court order. Harriet Trope and Joyce Touche met with Haas while Jones and John Victor retreated into the jungle. They explained to Haas that there was an assassination attempt on Jones and that he would not be accepting the order. The court official with Haas took copies of the order and attached them to a few of the settlement's buildings, where members immediately tore them down. Haas left and headed back to Georgetown, and the next day, Justice Bishop issued an arrest warrant for Jim Jones. Several days had passed, to the point that Temple members were so exhausted, they would never be able to fight anyone, let alone the Guyanese government. Jones got back on the radio and told Marcelin that everyone in Jonestown, quote, are prepared to die. Marcelin interpreted this to mean mass suicide. She begged for more time to locate Reed. She, Debbie Layton, and Terry Buford proceeded to make frantic phone calls. Marcelin finally got in touch with Reed in Indiana and assured that no Guyanese forces were going to attack Jonestown or come to arrest Jones. After Marcelin shared the news with Jones, he got on the loudspeaker and declared defending the siege on Jonestown was a victory. Haas returned to the United States, and Justice Bishop set a new hearing date for November. Jones felt that Reed may have taken offense to them tracking him down, so he wrote to him explaining his fear of losing his son, that he wanted to know where he stood, and that he grew tired of being politically harassed. Reed assured Jones that he would not be arrested anywhere in Guyana, but Jones didn't believe him. He knew there was another court date, and that his custody of John Victor and all the other Jonestown children was still at risk. The September 1977 night was the first of many, quote, white nights. White nights became a term used for occasions when Jones called everyone together to deal with a life-threatening, catastrophic event. To Jones, his enemies were only growing in number, and it would only be a matter of time before they all were going to come for him. This night would become, as some would say, the beginning to an end for Jim Jones in the People's Temple.
So I want to hold people. I would like to hold all of you in my arms, and so that you never have any more pain. Never have any more pain. Give you all the love I could give you, and then be able to grant you eternal rest. But I don't think it works that way unless it's through principle. I believe basically, morally, revolutionary suicide is the only kind of thing justified. And I'm very much concerned for you that if you commit suicide or try to die any other way, doing your own selfish thing or whatever, you will come back. I don't care. Hell, I've been back a million years. It seems like every day is a lifetime to me. What the hell's another life? I really don't mind anymore. You get to the point where you can take it or leave it, can't you? You get to the point where you can take it or leave it. Shit, it's just another day.
Promised Land is a Cool Down Media podcast. All audio clips for Promised Land come from the Jonestown Institute. For more information, visit their website at jonestown.sdsu.edu. Follow us on social media at Promised Land Cast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.